session number 25185,
Reel 4. Wilfred Osborne, Reel 4.
We flew off one aircraft to do submarine patrol, and the other walrus with the crew and the RPO flew off to go to Gibraltar. The pilot was given a message that he had to drop on the Renown for the Admiral. Having done that, he then flew down the port side of the Renown, and for some unknown reason, something happened. I think that the plane got caught, because we were doing 27 knots. The plane got caught in the downdraft of the funnels, and by the time the Renown had passed the spot, the plane had hit the water and went and sunk. The only survivor was the RPO. He was picked up, but unfortunately he died, and so we lost three more. So that made our casualties, doubled our casualties. We got back into Gib, and the captain decided that there would be no marching, no parades or anything, that anybody who wanted to go to Cathedral could go to pay their respects. And I think there was 400 of us in the Cathedral, and they held the service, and an RPO Marchand was buried in Gibraltar. His brother, who was on one of the destroyers, came, and I think the only other person other than the ship's company, the Sheffield, was Admiral Somerville. And that ended our Bismarck episode, very sadly.
What happened to HMS Sheffield after that?
We then carried on, and we were sent out into the Atlantic, because the Bismarck had a lot of supply ships dotted around. We caught up with one, and she scuttled. We sent a boarding party, or tried to get a boat, but she scuttled. And we took 90-odd prisoners, which we then brought back to Rosyth, and they were disembarked, and we had some leave. And that was the first time since 1939, that was nearly 2 years, that we'd been without leave, and so we look forward to that.
By this stage, you would have been an ordinary seaman. You'd no longer have been a boy.
I was made an ordinary seaman in January 1940, and an able seaman in October 1940, and I was still an AB. And I'd also passed a gunnery, third class gunnery rate, and I was a quarters rating as well.
Did that mean any change to your living conditions?
No, only the gunnery rate was threepence a day, more money, that's all. And the AB's pay was better.
You moved to another mess, obviously. You're no longer in the boys' mess.
No, I went on to I was a quarterdeckman, so I went on to the quarterdeckman's mess. And living, it wasn't any different. The food was the same. You still had to do cook of the mess, peel the spud, but life was much better, really, because you could go, especially when you was an AB, you could have all night leave. But when you was an ordinary seaman, you had to be back at midnight, and a boy, you had to be back at 9 o'clock. So there was a bit of difference.
You said when you got back to Rosyth, you allowed some proper leave.
Yeah, I think we had 10 days leave each watch, and then we went back to the Med. And this, our first convoy was through the Malta, and that was the only time we steamed into Grand Harbour on the Sunday, and we was thinking that we was going to have a run ashore in Malta, but by the dog watches, we slipped the buoy and made our way back to Gibraltar again. And then we were then sent in the autumn back to up to join the Home Fleet, and we were on Russian convoys through the winter, and in the spring of 42 we were mined, we'd topped up with oil, and we were on our way to meet, joined a convoy, and at 9 o'clock at night, or round about that time, we were mined. I was in the bathroom. I had a habit that before I closed up all night, I always liked to wash my feet and put a clean pair of socks on. I don't know why. And I was the only one in the bathroom, and I heard this explosion, and I hurried out the bathroom, and I caught my leg on the coping, and that bled, but that was nothing. And by 9:15 we closed up, and we were told that we'd been damaged. We lost a Royal Marine. He was the only one. He was a keyboard sentry, and the mine had hit underneath where he and it killed him. And so we made our way back to harbour in Iceland, and we spent 3 weeks there patching up the ship. We took all the coke that was ashore to fill up the hole, and eventually we made our way back to Scapa and then on to Newcastle. And I think we're the only ship that took coke to Newcastle, because when the ship went in the dock, it all, what was left, all fell into the dockyard, into the dock, and the dockyard mate just took it home. And I then left the ship.
Did you have any contact with the captain aboard the Sheffield, or any of the other officers?
Well, the only officer you really had any contact with was your divisional officer. You saw the other officers, and the first lieutenant, you might see him, and the commander, but no direct contact unless you were in trouble or doing something you shouldn't have been done. But other than if you were a defaulter or requestment, that's the only time you saw the commander or the captain. No direct. You saw them around the ship, which is obvious, but and they might speak to you, but not very often, you know.
What was the discipline like?
It was strict. Because you had to have that, you know. I mean, you couldn't have people doing what they liked. I mean, you had to have some sort of code of discipline. And this is where, I mean, when we were training, you used to think, well, why are we doing this, and what's the need of that? But having been through all that, you realise that this is necessary, and, you know, damage control and closing doors and portholes, not smoking on the upper deck during, you know, when it was dark, and all things like that. And you realise that it was for your own good, you know, and so you accepted it. Conditions sometimes weren't as good as they should be, especially in rough weather, you know. I mean, the water used to come over the forecastle and through the fan lights and flood, you know. You were living in water, and that, it wasn't the best of conditions, but you just put up with it because you were fighting a war.
Do you remember any special traditions that took place on board the Sheffield?
In what way?
Well, perhaps naval traditions in general, but the rum ration, for example.
Well, the rum was issued from the engineer's flat. but that was only for the people who were 20 and over and who were entitled to draw it. That was always issued at 10 to 12 each day. The rum bosuns used to go down, and the rum and the water was put into this big rum barrel, and each mess went up, and the supply chap said how many was entitled, and then the rum bosun would pour that amount into the fanny, which was then taken back to the mess and served out. All the surplus rum was supposedly to be thrown over the side, but when the war started, they used to do it all on the upper deck, but when the war started they went to the engineer's flat, and the nearest disposal point was the seaman's bathroom, and in the forward part of the bathroom were two bowls, and if you can imagine, the bowls were there and you lifted them up to clean them, you know, and then lowered them down. And nobody was allowed, these were specially clean, that was the bathroom sweeper's job. And they used to take the rum, the remnants of the rum, and they'd pour it into this wash basin, and they'd have something underneath to catch it. And they knew it was going on, but they used to turn a blind eye. So the tankie always had a couple of extra tots. The only other tradition that I can tell you is Christmas time, but unfortunately we never spent any Christmases in harbour, but the officers used to look after the ratings, and the youngest member used to dress up in the captain's uniform and do mess deck rounds, but we were always seemed to be away, you know, on the actual Christmas day, so it didn't happen.
Did you get a special Christmas dinner on Christmas Day?
Yes, yeah, egg and bacon, and we always used to have a bread roll, because we had our own bakery, so we had an individual bread roll, which was very nice. Lunch was, or dinner was, turkey or pork or something, tomato soup, Christmas pudding, nuts and that, Christmas cake, and then ham or something for supper. So it was a bit more special than on the other occasions.
Were there any special entertainments put on for Christmas Day?
No. It used to, just get your head down, or, people... quite a lot of them used to manage to get some extra drink aboard from somewhere, but other than that, there wasn't much going on, you know.
What was there by way of entertainment aboard the Sheffield during...
We had our own ship's company concert party, which was very good. We had our own cinema, which was on most when we were in harbour. So we had quite a bit of entertainment, and we had our own recreation room, and they'd be playing mahjong and things like that. Card schools were always going on. Not gambling, not officially, but it used to happen. But there was all. But time you came out, if you had the first dog watch. And you were crew defence stations, well, you just had time to have your supper, have a wash, and you were closing up again at 8 o'clock to midnight. Although on the Sheffield, we had a routine, whereas if you had the first dog watch, you then had your supper, you closed up till... and then we went to action stations at 9:15, and then one watch would carry on till 2 o'clock, and then the other watch would carry on till 8 o'clock. So some days you would be on watch more, about 20 hours, and the next day, not so bad. But we were always slept round the guns when we were at sea, and so you didn't have a lot of time. I mean, Tom, you'd done your dobing and writing your letters, hoping that the mail would go somewhere. You didn't have a lot of time to yourself at all.
Can you tell me what you did with your shore leave in Malta, for example?
Well, during the war, I mean, I never went. Jib was our main, Gibraltar was, I used to have a few beers, get drunk. But there wasn't a lot about anything else to do, you know, there was no plan. I mean, you just went ashore in Jib, found the first bar, went through the shops to see if what, you know, was on sale, nylon and stockings and things like that. But I used to go in the bars and, you know, sit there till it was time to go back aboard. Sometimes three parts worse for wear.
Were you allowed overnight leave in Gibraltar?
No. No, we're also, some people were, but only the privileged few, that was officers, I think. But no, it was always midnight. We were had to be back on board.
Did you ever get back late?
Big Ben?
Did you ever get back late?
No, I was one of the good boys.
Did you get into trouble at all on the Sheffield?
Once, during the time that... We had been mined. We had to work, you know, being a seaman, there was work to be done. And one afternoon they said that you could go ashore, but if you didn't go ashore, you had to turn to. And I decided that I wasn't going ashore and I wasn't going to turn to. And I got my head down on the mess deck stool, and I was shaken and put in the rattle. And that was the only time, and I spent 2 days hanging over the side, helping repair this hole. So I didn't do that anymore. But that's the only time that I was before the commander, all the time that I was on the Sheffield.
Do you have any particular memories of any of the ship's company? Any particular characters that spring to mind?
Well, our captain of the gun was Horace Farley. He was quite a character. He had no teeth. He was an AB, but he was all right when he was sober, but he was one of those who liked the rum. He was the drawing room sweeper, and he used to sleep in the drawing room when he could, and he was quite a character. There was another one named Edwards, who was, he was thick built and thick in the head, but he was another character. There was quite a few, you know, that got up to various things. There were a lot of characters. But to name them all, I don't think I could now, no.
What sort of scans did they get up to?
Get drunk. That was the first thing. Fight. And things like that. That was the sort of thing that they mostly, anyway.
During the time that you were in the Sheffield, how did you keep in contact with home?
Only by letter. We had one time where we went, I think, 3 or 4 months without any mail at all. As I said, we were always up and around, and the mail would be sent to somewhere and we'd be gone, and, you know, it took quite a while to catch up with us because there was no aircraft. It all had to go by ship. So, and that was the last thing. I mean, if ships were taking war supplies, there wasn't much room to put mail. So sometimes it went quite a long time. And then you get a 100 bags of mail come, and they did give us time to sit down and read it, but that's, yeah, you know, the only way was hopefully that when you got in the harbour there was mail waiting for you.
Did it affect morale on board not to
have mail? It did get, especially that time when we'd gone so long. I mean, people were getting a bit head up, you know, especially the married men. And I mean, a lot of them lived in London and places like that were being bombed, so they didn't really know what was going on to their relations, you see.
What was happening to your family during the war?
Well, they lived in the country, and my father was in the Home Guard, and he also ran the Home Guard, he formed a Home Guard band as well. But my mother, she didn't have very good health, so, but she was at home all the time. But that's, her father worked, as I said, worked on the farm, and they were working all hours, especially in the, you know, in the summer, to get the crops in and everything. So they had quite a hectic life, really, in a way.
Did your mother ever regret encouraging you to join the Navy?
Well, if she did, she never told me, no.
I don't know if you had a girlfriend or a sweetheart at this time.
I had one. I met a girl at my cousin's wedding, and we got engaged, and I used to send her money, and we were hopefully going to get married. And when I left the Sheffield for the second time, I had a feeling, she lived in Romford, and I had a feeling that all was not well. And I didn't go straight home, I went to her house. Her parents, her father was in the army, her mother and all her younger sister and brother had been evacuated, and she was at home with her brother and one sister. And the second night I was home, she said she didn't want anything more to do with me, and that was it. I was, you know, I was a bit downhearted because I really thought a lot of her, and but it wasn't to be. So that was the only really girlfriend I had the whole war. I had one or two other young ladies, but I won't tell you about those. And then after I left the Sheffield for the second time, I went in and did another gunnery course. In the meantime, I've been rated leading seaman. There was one episode.
Perhaps before we go on to that, yeah. Sorry, probably got a little bit off chronological track, yeah. Anyway. The first time you left the Sheffield must have been in the...
April 42.
Exactly.
Yeah.
What happened to you after that?
I went to Chatham Barracks, was watchkeeping, and that's during the time I met this young lady. And then in 1943... I was sent for to the drafting office, and when you were given the draft then, you it was a number. You didn't know what ship it was going. And I went down to the drafting office, stood at the window, and Able Seaman Osborne, and the chap RPO said, "Oh, HMS Sheffield," and I said, "Well, can I have something different? I've just been a boarder." He said, "No, you Sheffield, you're going." So I rejoined her in the Clyde, and she been damaged by heavy weather, and we had a refit there, and then we left there, and it's a bit vague. We did a working up period, and then we were attached to back to the home fleet, as far as I can remember. During that period, I passed for leading seaman, and also a cousin, a chief stoker, who was a chief stoker, joined. He'd been a survivor of the Katies, and he joined us. I remember we went to Plymouth, and we were attached to the Channel fleet, because they were still worried about invasion. And the next point was in the, we carried on in the autumn and the winter of Russian convoys, and then the winter of 1943, we were on a convoy when the Shahnoz broke out, and we were ordered to cover this convoy, and we steamed up and down the Arctic. And I can remember that we could always tell when we were steaming north, because I was then a gun layer in A turret, and the condensation would freeze, and as the further north we went, there were icicles in the turret, and then as we turned south, we had to put our oilskins on, because it was a continuous drip of, you know, this condensation melting, and the wells of the turret were full up with water sloshing around. We had to sleep in that, because we were closed up most of the time.
How did they get rid of the ice in the turrets or on the guns?
Well, you just had to, as I say, it melted, and then you just mopped it up and chucked it out through one of the holes in the rear of the turret, and tried to make conditions as best as we could. The Scharnhorst do was quite more frightening to me than the Bismarck, because I was in a tin box, really. All I knew was I had to lay the gun and follow this direct pointer, and we were told some things, but we didn't know what was going on, really. And we fired quite a few rounds at the Scharnhorst. Then, unfortunately for us, we had engine trouble. I think one of the shafts went wrong, and we were doing 27 knots, and we were reduced down to 6 or 8 knots while they tried to repair it. During that time, as I said, I was a gun layer, we were closed up, and we were then told that there was a ship, because if you can imagine, it was dark nearly all the time, so they didn't have much idea what was about. We knew the Scharnhorst was around, and this range kept coming down till it was down to less than 8,000 yards, and we loaded the gun and thought, well, this is it. And it turned out it was one of our destroyers, thank goodness, and we were very relieved.